Now that heart is beating fast, and that's the rhythm I can dance to. I'm mighty glad I've got a chance to that one big heart that's beating fast. Tomorrow morning, let it rain. Tomorrow morning, let it pour. Tonight, we're in the groove together. Ain't gonna worry about stormy weather. Gonna kick old trouble out the door. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. Beat out old trouble on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Beat me that rhythm on the drum. And kick old trouble out the door. Kick him 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 out the door.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. My name is Joseph Toscano. Yes, we're broadcasting live. No boring repeats today. The program will be podcast. I've been assured by Michaela, who stepped in to assist two elderly, bumbling people to go to air. Now, Steve, what's your surname?
Jager.
But
J-A-G-E-R.
Jager.
Yes, correct.
And how many bloody horrible jokes do people make about your surname?
I've heard Jager. I've heard Jagger.
Yeah, Jagger. Yeah.
There's a few. There's a few different spellings.
Yeah, but the only thing about the only thing you got going for you regarding you and Mick is you're both bloody skin and bone.
Yeah,
that's about it. Yeah.
And we both like to sing.
You like to sing?
I love to sing, mate.
Well, I'm going to get you to sing later on in the program.
I can sing you a ballad that I wrote not too long ago, actually.
How long ago did you write it?
At the end of last year. It's called The Bushranger's Bullock Dray.
All right, we'll do it as the end.
It's a bit of a play on the pub with no beer.
So a cappella, obviously.
Yes, correct.
Oh, brilliant. What year were you born, Steve?
83.
1983. Yeah, you're not a ghost from 1883, because that's the area of your research.
Well, a lot of people think I was born in the wrong
century.
Correct.
But 83.
Yes, born in 1983.
And where were you born?
I was born down in Frankston.
Frankston. That's right. You were born there in 83.
Yeah, I was born down Frankston, 83, and have lived pretty much around that area my whole life.
Oh, look, it's a good area.
I love it.
People don't realise how good it is.
No, well, when you've got the beach just down the road,
it's a brilliant beach.
It is.
Yeah, it's a great place.
And lots of history down the peninsula as well.
Yeah. Are your parents still alive?
I lost my dad a couple of years ago.
Yeah, what was he like as a dad?
He was absent, but when he was around, he was present.
Right.
And would give great advice that I'd always carry through my life, and a lot of the advice and things that he did for me while I was growing up actually helped me become the person I am today. So
what's his name? What was his name?
Mick Hogan. He was an interstate truck driver.
Interstate truck driver.
Yeah. And then, like a lot of families from the 80s, dad and mum ended up splitting up and raised by a single mum with two older brothers.
What's your mum's name?
Andrea.
And she's still in Frankston?
Yep, mum's still down that way.
Same house? Same house.
Same house I was born in.
Really?
Yep, she bought it on, she paid for it with her single parent pension while she was raising us three kids.
Right. What was it like raising three bloody boisterous young boys, adolescents? It must have been pretty rough.
Yeah, well, we're different ages as well. So,
what are the ages of your brothers? Roughly.
52, 46, and I'm 42.
Oh, not that much.
Yeah.
Not much.
But we had lots of the boys, the local boys hanging around the house when we were growing up as well.
Yeah.
And we're always out in the streets exploring and down at the Cannanook Creek building, cubby houses.
Yeah, so your mum wasn't a helicopter parent, obviously.
No.
They didn't exist in those days.
No. Well, she's never even owned her license, so...
Right.
Yeah, so us kids were always just left to our own devices and would go out and make our own adventures.
Yeah, that's what they'd say. But there was one thing she'd say.
What's that?
Come home before dark or you don't get fed.
Yes, or as soon as the streetlights were on, you knew it was time to go, home.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, yeah. And if you drowned, you drowned. That's the way, it went.
Yeah, that's it.
So where did you go to school?
I went to Cannanook Primary.
Yep.
And then it ended up at Coringle Secondary, which merged with Ballon Park and became Coringle Park Secondary College, which it's now, I believe, Elizabeth Murdoch College?
Yeah.
No, McClelland College.
McClelland, that's right.
McClelland. Yeah.
So it was like, what was it like? What was primary school like for you?
Well, I grew up with epilepsy. I was diagnosed when I was around grade 3. So, and back in the 80s, not many kids knew what epilepsy was. They just thought it was contagious or not.
No, they just thought you were spaz. That's the words they used to use. He's a spaz.
Then with the red hair as well. You know, made me a bit of a target through my primary school and high school years.
Right. So in primary school, so it was pretty tough for you?
Yeah, primary school and high school was very, very tough for me.
Right. So were you taking medications after grade 3?
For the epilepsy, I was trialled on lots of different medications.
Right.
Until I eventually grew out of my seizures in my teenage years.
Right. Were your seizures associated with temperatures usually?
Not sure.
Yeah.
And they're not sure whether I was born with epilepsy or whether it was something I'd picked up over the years or not. Yeah. So
too many knocks to the head.
Yeah, probably.
By your brothers, most likely. We'll blame them.
Playing cricket out in the street in the footy.
Yeah. So did you finish high school?
No.
What happened? No. What happened, mate? What happened, Steve?
I was politely asked to move on.
You were politely asked to move
on. I was politely asked to move on.
And can I ask why?
I lashed out. Well, for years I'd put up with the bullying and I never lashed out.
Yep.
And then it hit, I was in year 11, halfway through year 11, and I lashed out, which resulted in a almost 50-day suspension, which is, you never hear of it.
No.
Eventually the school brought me back in, but they had already done the half-year exams and told me that I'd have to stay back and repeat. So I decided it was time to move on and concentrate on building my future as a historian and researcher.
Hang on.
I've been doing this my whole life.
No, excuse me. No. Hang on. No, look. How old were you?
16, 17.
Look, I hate to say this to you, Steve. You're a little bit abnormal. Most 16 and 70-year-olds are into sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah, that's correct.
So what went wrong? Was it the epilepsy?
No. maybe the medications they were trying me on. But, yeah, as a teenager, I used to hang out in the city and go to the nightclubs
with
my cousins and whatnot. But the Ned Kelly history, it's been part of my life since I was a young child. So
how come?
Family connections.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we used to go and stay out at my grandma's house in Blackwood in central Victoria during the school holidays when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
I remember annoying my grandma one day and her telling us to go outside or telling me to go outside and play bush rangers.
Oh, right.
What's a bush ranger?
Yeah, not cowboys and Indians, bush ranger.
Correct.
Yeah, bush ranger. Very Australian.
Yes. Yeah. And she told me bush rangers, Ned Kelly, and that her mum knew Ned Kelly and the family lived in Greater. I was under 10 at that time.
Right.
And so obviously I took it with a grain of salt, but the excitement was there and went outside and started playing bush rangers.
Right.
Got back to
Hang on, Steve. I'm a bit confused.
Sorry,
here. You know, I know cowboys and Indians, you have fake guns and bows and arrows.
Yeah.
How do you play bush rangers?
With sticks.
With sticks.
Sticks.
Stick
guns.
Stick guns.
Stick guns.
All right. And who do you stick up as a kid?
You use your imagination.
You use your imagination.
Yeah, you use your imagination.
All right. So there is a lifelong
That's
interest.
Correct. I had a fallen tree that was my horse.
Oh, right. You had a fallen tree. Yeah, there was a fallen tree that was my horse. Yeah, yeah.
And then the back veranda of my grandma's house, because it's got the veranda.
Yep.
That was the jail.
The jail,
as well. And she lived in between two old 1800s churches as well.
Right.
One of them, the Church of England, where Captain Moonlight was alleged to have given sermons while he's a lay preacher at Bacchus Marsh.
All right. Well, we'll go back to the history later on, but I'm really interested in your development. So, look, were you a rich kid? Did you win Ted Slaughter?
No.
So what did you do to support your addiction to history, to bushranging history? What did you do to make a crust? The legal bits, I want to know.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. My mum likes to tell the story of the day she got a phone call from the school library.
The school library.
No, mum called the school asking why I was bringing so many books home all the time.
Right. So I like that.
I wouldn't bring like two or three books home. I'd bring like 10 books home.
Right.
And half of them would be bare bush rangers.
Right.
And then I got to a point where I just constantly just reburrow them over and over. And if anyone wanted to know about Ned Kelly, they had to come and find me in the school.
Because you had the books.
Because I had all the books.
Right. Yep. So your mother was concerned because you're reading too much.
Yeah. So
it happens.
And then, yeah, once the school informed her that I was the one who was actually collecting all the books to read and they weren't being forced upon me,
she realised
that, you know, he's got a bit of intellect even at this young age.
Right. So 16. Kicked out of school. No, you're mutually parted. We won't use the word kicked out of school. Mutually parted ways. What did you do to earn a living? Because, you know, history research is time consuming and you've still got to eat and clothe yourself.
Correct.
So what did you do?
I ended up working at an abattoirs down towards Frankston, gather coals.
Yep. And what were you the rouseabout in the abattoir?
No, actually I wasn't. I was working on the kill floor.
Yep.
Washing the lambs, removing hocks.
Right.
And then I was transferred from there to the nighttime loadout.
Right.
And then within 3 months, at the age of 19, I was pretty much the second in charge of the place.
Right.
And I would go to work and do my research at times and hours when it wasn't affecting the people in my life and my life. My personal and private life. So
how would you do the research? Did you go to sites? Did you look for sites or mainly books?
No, well, Mum never had a license, so I was never able to get up to.
Well, at 19, you should have had a bloody license.
No, I didn't get my license until I was 23.
Why, because of the epilepsy?
Epilepsy and life circumstances.
That's right.
So
right.
Eventually got my license at 23, started driving up to Cali Country.
Right. Hang on. I want some definitions, mate.
No worries.
I want some definitions here because I think I'm confused and a lot of our, well, maybe our
listeners.
One of our two listeners is confused. Can you define for me a bushranger? What is a bushranger?
It was a term coined by Reverend Knopwood, who was a famous reverend down in Tasmania, and Sorrento as well, believe it or not, before it moved to Derwent River.
It's all right, you can cough. We don't have a cough button.
Sorry, guys.
No, don't worry.
It was a term coined by Reverend Knopwood to explain the runaway convicts from their settlements.
The runaway convicts, because they had to eat.
Yes, correct.
And, these
convicts who were ranging around the bush.
Right, right.
And that's where the term came from.
Bush ranging. Because they were ranging around the bush.
Correct.
All right. Now, very early bush ranging history, I'm talking about, you know, 20, 30 years after colonisation began.
Yeah,
say in Tasmania and New South Wales before Victoria was illegally settled. What were the relationships like between the Aboriginal people and the bushrangers? Obviously, there would have been a whole series of different interactions.
Well, when you mentioned that, the first thing that came to mind was the famous ballad Moreton Bay.
Right.
And it talks about Captain Logan, who was the commander of the Moreton Bay convict settlement, and how heavy-handed he was in his punishments. And one of the local Indigenous witnessing this over and over, day after day, and hearing these screams and cries, eventually threw a spear over the fence and took his life.
Right.
So the Indigenous could see what the convicts were going through, and they would actually protect them when the convicts would run away from the convict settlements in a lot of cases. For example, Pemulwuy.
Yep.
Pemulwuy had two white convict runaways who were part of his gang.
Right, right. So that's the early days.
Yes, that's correct.
So in those days, would they wouldn't have used horses, would they? There wouldn't have been many horses in those early days?
No, it would have been more walking around as groups.
Ranging.
Ranging through the bush.
Yeah. And what parts of society did they target? This is in the early days.
Mainly it was the early settlers who came along with the convict settlements.
Right.
So when we would have, when a new convict settlement would be set up, for example, down at Sorrento in 1802, there was a number of settlers, free settlers, who came along with those convicts under Lieutenant David Collins.
Yep.
And they set up their homesteads behind the actual convict settlement. So they weren't within the boundaries of the jail, to say.
So they were ripe for picking.
That's correct.
So if you're an escaped convict.
That's right. You would head out into the bush and then watch and wait and for these homesteads to be empty and come down and plunder.
Plunder, as they say.
Which is now a great term we use here in Australia. Like
salt and flour, that type of plunder. And possibly a loose gun that's left. Yeah, because we're not talking about gold at that stage. No, we're talking about just stuff.
The discovery of gold hadn't occurred.
That's right. Okay. So how did the discovery of gold change the nature of bushranging?
Finding gold in Australia made every man equal.
Mm.
There were people from all walks.
Not everybody wins Tats Lotto, mate.
Yeah. But a lot of people... Yeah,
a lot of people buy tickets. A lot of people buy tickets.
Yes, that's very true. But there were people from all walks of life who were giving up their day jobs to come over to Australia.
Yeah.
And a lot of these ex-convicts at the time didn't really want to do the digging and the work.
Oh, right. And shirkers.
And so... The government had to create a gold escort system in order to save these miners who were getting bailed up from the gold diggings.
Right. So what miners would actually...
So they'd find their gold and then they'd have to travel down to Melbourne to cash it in.
They couldn't cash it in locally?
No, not at the beginning.
Beginning, right.
And so the bushrangers became very prolific and would bail these travellers up until the goldfields started introducing banks in tents, etc.
So by then, I assume bushrangers were using horses.
Yes, but that's correct.
They were using horses by then.
And the gold escort was known to carry tens of thousands of pounds and gold. And made them, and everyone in the town always knew when the gold escort was to depart.
Yeah.
So it became a new target for the bushrangers.
Mm. Can you tell us of any particular spectacular gold hoists?
Well, we had the ship Nelson was raided in Port Phillip Bay.
Right.
By a number of criminals, ex-convicts.
What year was this?
I believe it was in the 1850s. I can't remember the exact date.
Could have been 83, 84.
I haven't researched the Nelson in particular.
No, but it was raided.
And I think it was up to £1 million worth of gold was removed from the ship. But the police ended up catching up with the criminals.
Really?
Yep. There was also the Mackay.
So what happened to those chaps?
Many of them were actually hanged, I believe.
Right.
Yep, at the Melbourne jail.
Right.
What else?
Any big kind of...
Oh, the other ones. The MacGyver Gold Escort, which was the first attempted gold escort robbery in Victoria.
Right.
Or Australia.
Yep.
Not many people know, but the bushranger Frank Gardner, he actually lived down the road from where that occurred.
Right.
And Frank Gardner went on to be the leader of the Yugara Gold Escort robbery in New South Wales.
Right.
Which was successful and became the biggest gold escort robbery here in the country.
Mm. How did the bushrangers treat each other?
Friendly.
Friendly?
Friendly, because they were all on the same page.
Right. They were all running from the law.
Yes, correct. But I just had a thought, which some of the listeners would know as well. There's the story of Captain Moonlight when he was leaving Victoria in 1879 after the police harassment he was receiving.
Mm.
Put a call out to Ned Kelly asking to join join up.
Yeah.
The Moonlighters and the Kelly Gang. And apparently Ned sent word back and said, if you come anywhere near me, I'll shoot you.
Right. So you're going to take over my patch.
Yeah.
Did specific gangs have specific areas? It's like say drug runners.
It really depended on where a lot of people grew up. So Ben Hall was comfortable throughout the Forbes, Yugara district.
Mm.
Dan Morgan was more comfortable down in the Riverina district.
Mm.
And then you had the Kellys who were hanging around Glen Rowan, Greta.
This is what, 20 years after the gold rushes?
Yes, correct.
Because would you call that the golden era of bushranging? I mean, I'm being facetious.
No, it's very interesting because I like to highlight that we started off with the convict runaway bushrangers.
Yeah.
Then we moved into the bushrangers who were inspired by the gold.
Yep.
And then you had the cattle duffers.
Yep.
And it seems like we've got a new series of bushranging where these young kids, such as Ned Kelly, join bushrangers such as Harry Power or William Monckton with Captain Thunderbolt, John Dunn with Ben Hall.
Yep.
And it was a way to quickly get famous in a way.
Famous?
Yes.
Not rich, famous. Not
rich and famous.
Rich and famous.
But
sounds like a gangster movie.
Yes, but to a short life and a merry one is what...
A short and merry one.
Yes, is a term that many of the bushrangers claim to have said when taking to the roads.
All right, I'm interested in the Kelly Gang for... only one reason, really. Well, there's a lot of reasons, but the one I'm really interested in, which I want to work out with you, is, you know, the Eureka Rebellion happened in 1854,
right? Correct.
The Victoria Police had a riot and there was a massacre, and there was at least 50 miners were massacred by the Victoria Mounted Police, which had been formed in 1853. Now, the people responsible, although the Royal Commission said they should be held to account, were never held to account, and they continue to hold their positions in society, you know, in the central goldfields, you know, in Ballarat, Bendigo, Dalesford, all those places, they continue to hold. Do you think the fact that the descendants of the rebels were living amongst the descendants of the people who were responsible for the killing had any bearing on the formation of these gangs, because the descendants and even the ones involved in the killings were still in the positions of authority and were actually, abusing their authority as they did during 1854?
Yeah, I do, because when you look at Ned Kelly's career, he wasn't your typical bushranger.
So tell us about his career.
Well, Ned Kelly highlighted the police police persecution of not just him and his family, but of ex-convicts, people who had served their time and had received ticket of leaves and had become free men, and the harassment that they continued to face.
Mm-hmm.
The overreach of societies like the Stock Protection Society of Northeast Victoria, which would offer private rewards to police officers.
Ah, a little bit like the gold diggings, where if you didn't have a license and you prosecuted somebody, you got a percentage of the...
Yeah.
So, but these were vigilantes, basically.
Yeah, correct. And it created a secret society of bounty hunters amongst the Victoria Police at the time.
Right.
Because you've got to remember, Australia was still a new colony and it was still in the developmental stages surrounding the political aspect.
Yeah.
So obviously there was going to be... it wasn't going to be smooth sailing during the settlement of the country.
I know you're particularly interested in the Kelly Gang, so we'll concentrate on that for 10 minutes or so, but I'm also interested in a lot of the other people. So how did things start off for Ned, young Ned? What happened? What got him on this path?
He'd lost his father at the age of 11 and a half.
Right.
And it seems that he'd gone through a funk of depression.
Right.
And 2 years later, An escaped convict named Harry Power had broken out of Pentridge and made his way up to the northeast of Victoria.
Somebody broke out of Pentridge.
Yes.
Not bad. Not bad, yeah.
And happened to stop by the Kelly homestead.
Yep.
And Ned was offered the role of holding Harry Power's horses while he committed his famous robberies.
Hang on, hang on. How old was Ned?
13.
13.
13.
So the lads would ride up to somewhere and they were worried about their horses. Ned would be holding the horses and they'd jump on the horses and that's
well,
it.
Well, Harry Power would ride up to the place where he's going to bail up people.
Yep.
And then he'd set Ned in the bush to the side, holding the two horses, and tell Ned to keep his face hidden. So that way he couldn't be identified and charged.
Mm.
So when he's riding with Harry Power, he operated out near the castle main goldfields rather than in the northeast district where he was more than likely going to be recognised.
Recognised. And how long this going for?
It went on. Well, they had a run-in at Dr. Rowe's Mount Battery Station in, I think it was May 1869.
Mm-hmm.
Then they've had a little break as Harry Power went up into New South Wales, and then on his return he's picked up Ned and they've continued over into the Kyneton district in April 1870.
So he's a bit of a lad.
Yeah.
He's uncontrollable, you reckon?
I think it was more so he'd lost his father and Alan wanted Ned to get a bit of experience in the bush.
Oh, right.
So it was more so a learning curve for Ned.
So how did this develop?
Well, after the police had tried to set Ned up to be known as Harry Power's informer, and the truth eventually came out, Ned was, as I said, found not guilty on all charges.
How old was he then?
14.
14,
yeah,
right.
So he's found not guilty on all charges of being the accomplice to Harry Power.
Yep.
And he was released.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, when he returned to Greta, the local police tended to harass him because they weren't successful, not just him, but him and his family. Yeah, correct.
Especially his mum. He was really upset about that.
Yeah, that's correct.
Because she was working hard to keep the family together. So what was his next move?
He was actually trying to help a local hawker move his horse that had been caught in the mud, his horse and cart, and the hawker had taken off.
Yep.
So Ned had borrowed a horse to remove it.
Yep.
McCormick, that's called the McCormick incident.
Mm-hmm.
Ned ended up writing a bit of a cheeky letter.
All right.
And included a couple of calf's testicles in the letter and sent it to McCormick.
All right.
And he was eventually charged with obscene language or...
And found guilty.
Yeah. And so after he was released from that charge, he was back at 11 Mile Creek.
Yeah.
And his sister had married Alex Gunn. Right. Alex Gunn was friends with Wild Wright.
Right.
Wild Wright had lost his horse,
right,
which was the Mansfield postmaster's horse.
Mm-hmm.
Asked Ned to help him find it. Long story short, Ned found it, was riding through town, Greta, and the local policeman, Constable Hall, pretty much pulled him off the horse and tried to shoot him.
Mm.
The gun misfired a number of times before the police officer took the butt of the pistol and started beating him about the head.
Well, you'd be 16, 17.
Yeah, so he was only 16, 17. He ended up doing 3 years hard labour for receiving a stolen horse, whereas Wild, the one who stole the actual horse, he only received 18 months.
Right.
Coming out of jail from there, Ned realised, time to get my act straight.
Yep.
And for a number of years, he worked at sawmills in the local area and was known to help a lot of the local families breaking in horses, fencing in their yards, whatever help they needed.
Right.
Trying to change the public's perspective of him being this young kid bushranger who was going to project on the path of an outlaw, which is not what he aimed for.
No. So what pushed him on down that path?
Well, it seems like the police up in the Northeast District, a number of police, not all of them, during those times, were involved with the Kelly gang or the Greta mob in moving stolen horses between Victoria and New South Wales. And there seems to have been a falling out amongst these police officers and the Greta mob at some stage, which has then resulted in Fitzpatrick or the harassment coming against the Kellys.
So who was in the Kelly gang?
The Kelly gang was made up of numerous people. So Ned Kelly, the leader.
Yep.
Dan Kelly, his younger brother. His best friend, Steve Hart, who lived out at Wangaratta. And Ned Kelly's best friend was Joe Byrne, who lived out at the Woolshed Valley. And was fluent in Cantonese, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And grew up on the Chinese gold diggings amongst the Chinese diggers.
So they'll get in that little bit of fame at that stage?
They were known as the Greta mob, and they were known to be very flash.
Flash.
And they would ride town to town and have what we would call a pub crawl now through town. And then they'd leave town rowdy, screaming on their horses.
What was their relationship like with the local population? Because you really can't be a bushranging gang without support from the public.
They were the sons of ex-convicts and known horse stealers and so was the inspiration was there from their surroundings.
But what I'm saying is how much support did they have amongst the public? Obviously, there's the stuff you read in the newspapers that period, and then I always found it interesting that they survived for so long, and you can't do that without support.
No. They had a lot of support. There's no doubt about it. They were, a lot of the people up in that area knew how the police would act and abuse their powers.
Right.
And so that's where the support for the Kelly gang came from.
So do you think they were more than bandits?
Yeah, they were political fighters.
Tell us why.
Well, it starts off with the Kellys robbing the Ural Bank in order to raise funds to pay for Alan Kelly's defence. Then the police, a month later, rounded up, I think it was 30 sympathisers, and then held them for remand in Beechworth Jail for 3 months without any charge or any evidence being produced against any of them. And this was devastating to a lot of the families because their main breadwinner had been taken away.
No social security benefits.
Yep. And so Ned and the gang chose to rob the Giraldary Bank in order to spread the funds from that robbery to those families so they could pay for legal defences. They were eventually released, and as a result, Superintendent Sadlier wrote a list of names of known and alleged sympathisers and passed the blacklist, as we call it, onto the Crown Lands Department down here in Melbourne with the order to deny any person who applied for land, deny a request for any person on that list who applied for land in northeast Victoria.
Tell us about the Giraldary letter. What is that?
It's what Ned Kelly called the story of my life.
Right.
It was a letter highlighting his political stance and also he's trying to incite a worldwide Irish rebellion, if I could put it in that sense. So the idea was to rob the bank, publish the letter, which would then be picked up by other newspapers and mass published. But after Ned handed that letter over, it was never published in the Giraldary Gazette. It was brought back down here to Melbourne to be used as evidence against him by the police at a later time. And so, he really he really didn't. Sorry, I'm just losing my train of thought.
That's all right. I can talk over you.
Yeah,
if you
go
want
for
me
it.
To. All right. Look, I'll change the conversation. Let's get back to when he was arrested. Right. Now this.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. All this. Well, tell us then.
All right. Inciting Irish worldwide rebellion. So if, in the letter, he talks about what would England do if America declared war, as it's all Irishmen who has command of her forts, her arms and her batteries, and even her very, lifeguards.
So it's really something, it's pretty sophisticated for, what, it would have been 24 around that time, 25?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
But you would also know about the Catalpa rescue in 1876 with the Fenians.
Mm.
And so this, I believe, was a very, very strong inspiration for the Kellys. And Ned was trying to get the attention of the Irish Brotherhood in the States.
Well, it's funny, you know, the Protestant-Catholic divide is irrelevant today, but in those days it was fundamental.
Huge.
It was fundamental in terms of your social standing and, more importantly, in terms of how far you could go in society. And if you were descendant from Irish Catholic stock, you were basically... You know, all those Irish jokes, it's all about you basically being semi-skilled or unskilled labourer. That's it. That's the best you could do.
That's very true.
Yeah, that's the way it was. Now, we'll just speed this up. Now, where did this metal armour business come from?
Ben Hall had been shot 27 times only.
27 times?
Yeah, 27. Ben Hall was chased and shot 27 times by, I think it was 8 police in 1865.
Yep.
So being a bushranger, the most wanted one in Australia, he knew what was coming.
Right.
It was build something to avoid being riddled.
Yeah.
And then he realised that he could use that armour in order to have close quarters combat inside banks or police stations in order to control the narrative.
Right, right. So how, what happened at Stringybark?
Well, there were a number of police who went out in search of Ned after he'd been, after the attempted murder of Constable Fitzpatrick, or the alleged attempted murder of Constable Fitzpatrick at the 11 Mile. Four police went out in search of the Kelly Gang: Sergeant Michael Kennedy, Constable Lonigan, Constable Scanlon, and Constable McIntyre, who was known as the aide de camp, the camp assistant, camp cook.
Yeah.
The Kellys realised the police were in close proximity, so decided it was best to bail them up, steal their horses and their firearms, and send them back to town.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, three of the police immediately drew their rifles, which resulted in Ned firing.
Right. Okay. So they were eventually arrested.
The Kellys.
Was the whole crew arrested or not?
No. So they were involved in the last stand at Glen Rowan, where they planned to have the train derailed or stop the train on the tracks and take command of it. And three of the Kelly gang perished inside Ann Jones's hotel. Joe Byrne was shot through the femoral artery.
Mm-hmm.
Dan and Steve Kelly allegedly committed suicide, Ned Kelly was captured while trying to come back to the hotel to save his brother and Dan Kelly.
Right, and obviously he was taken to Melbourne eventually. Yeah. So it's very interesting, the trial, because I'm interested in the trial because the judge who Ned Kelly appeared before, Redmond Barry, has got an interesting history, not just his... the fact that he had five children out of wedlock and didn't recognise the mother, but that's a different story.
I know that story.
Yeah, but the the fact that he was the defence counsel for Tanaminua and Morbohina in 1842, and he was also one of the judges in the Eureka trials.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
He played a huge role in Melbourne's development with the National Gallery of Victoria and State Library too.
And you've got his little statue there at the State Library with the little spikes to keep the seagulls from shitting on his head. That's still there. So, obviously he was found guilty.
Yes, Ned was found guilty and sentenced to hang at Melbourne Jail.
How old was he?
He's only 25.
25.
25 years young.
Mm, mm.
But he is well ahead of his years.
Right.
You know, his story encapsulates the Australian identity of mateship, courage, standing up for your rights, fighting for your rights and your beliefs.
Yep.
And the political aspect, he took it to the government.
Yeah,
he was the only one who had the balls to stand up and say, no, you can't treat people the way you've been treating them.
Right.
You know, if we read his final letter, he says, police may not exasperate to madness people they persecute and ill-treat. You know, my life will not be entirely thrown away.
And what do you think about the so-called quote, such is life, on the gallows? Did that occur or is it?
It definitely occurred. I've just done a very, very thorough study on that subject, which I've published on the Australian Bushrangers Facebook page.
Could you tell us how people can access that?
Yep. So if you go to Facebook and put in Australian Bushrangers, you'll see pinned at the top of the page the Such Is Life reports, parts 1, 2, and 3,
right,
which conclusively prove that Ned Kelly said the term Such Is Life twice during the execution process.
Right.
The first time around 9 o'clock when he was informed the hour of execution had been set for 10 o'clock and all avenues of reprieve had been exhausted, Such Is Life. And when stepping onto the gallows, which was heard by Father Dean Donaghy, who recorded it in his personal journal.
Such is life.
Such is life.
The other fascinating thing about his hanging was that it was actually on the 11th.
Yeah, Armistice Day.
Not only that, 11th of November is a very famous day. It's the day the Ballarat Reform League was formed in 1854.
Oh, wow.
It's the date that Ned Kelly was hung in 1880. It's the date Armistice Day 1918. It's the day the Whitlam-led Labor government was dismissed on the 11th of November 1975. So historically, you've got these four significant events in Australian history which all occurred on the 11th of November. It's
that
just extraordinary.
There's the something new I've learnt today.
Oh, well, I haven't, you have. But everybody knows the three old ones, but the Ballarat Reform League one is the really one that I discovered about 20 years ago, which I was fascinated by.
I think
by.
That's
And the other thing I was interested in is people fought.
Incredible coincidence.
And, when you look at the newspaper reports of the period, it's as if he had no supporters. Now, I understand there was around 6,000 to 8,000 people turned up at the Old Melbourne Jail, and there was a riot on the evening of his.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had support.
He had a lot of support. He had a lot of support. Obviously, the newspapers are biased depending on what side of the fence they sit on. There was newspaper journalists who were very sympathetic to the Kelly's plight up in the Northeast District, such as the.
Doesn't matter.
Beechworth Advertiser.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Now, I've got to ask you a few other questions about Bushrangers because we've only got about 12 minutes and I want to hear. How long is that song of yours?
It only goes for, I think, a minute and a half.
Ah, perfect.
Yep.
Now, female Bushrangers.
Yes, there was a few.
Can you tell us about a few of the more, how shall I put it, the more well-known?
The most famous female Bushranger, Marianne Bugg, who was Captain Thunderbolt's partner.
And she was Aboriginal.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
Michael Howe, the Tasmanian bushranger, he also had an Aboriginal partner.
Yeah.
And there was a cattle duffer in the 1920s up in New South Wales. Her name was Jessie Hickman, and she was known for raiding a lot of properties in that local area.
Right.
For their horses, and she lived in a cave up in the mountains.
Mm. Would you recommend this lifestyle to people? Not today, but in those days. I mean, it's short, isn't it?
I think it comes down to a person's life circumstances.
No.
So if we look at Dan Morgan, for example, a lot of his crimes were enacted out of paranoia or fear that he was about to be captured.
Right.
He was also spent a lot of time in Castlemaine Jail, Pentridge, on the prison hulks.
Yeah.
So there's potential for PTSD to have occurred as well.
So, is that why he was called Mad Dog Morgan?
No, he was only called Mad Dog after my good friend Philippe Mora's 1970 film featuring Dennis Hopper.
So he was never known
Mad Dog during his lifetime.
And he did have his head cut off, didn't he, after
his
shot?
Yes, by Dr. Halford, who was also the professor at University of Melbourne, who I believe took Ned Kelly's skull.
That's interesting. Now, when Pentridge was closed down and they redeveloped it, you were involved in finding the...
Locating the remains of Pentridge.
Right. So there was no skull?
No, there was no skull. There was only a portion of the skull found with the remains.
Why, do you think they took his brain too?
So that tells us that they did remove his brain, the saw marks on the skull and on the base of the vertebrae, so post-mortem marks. But the thing was, there was a law during the 1860s after Captain Melville's wife had displayed his body in her oyster shop window on Bourke Street after he was executed.
Yep.
And so the law to release bodies to family members was repealed.
Right.
And the night before Ned was executed, he was asked the question by the jail doctor, Dr. Shields, whether he wanted a post-mortem examination to be conducted on his body. Ned said, "There's no need for that. You already know how I'm going to..." So the next day after he was executed, the law wasn't followed, and the sheriff of the jail, Robert Reed, connections to the Eureka Stockade.
That's right.
Robert Reed stepped forward and said, "He doesn't get to make that decision. I'll make that decision." And so a post-mortem was illegally conducted on Ned Kelly's remains.
So where do you think poor old Ned's head is?
I believe it is at the University of Melbourne.
You believe?
I strongly, strongly believe, based on my previous meetings I've had with curators of the Harry Brooks Museum of Anatomy and Pathology, and the university have privately acknowledged to me that they have records in their archives that state they had Ned Kelly's skull, Dan Morgan's skull, King Jimmy Dunbar, who was the last of the Mordialloc tribe, but he's actually a Woiwurrung man, and a number of extinct species and artifacts, but where they've gone to and when they disappeared, we don't know.
But they do know. They may not.
But they do know.
It's a mystery, as they say. So any other particular bushrangers have taken your fancy? Victorian.
All of them. So the Ned Kelly story came about from my own personal family connections.
Yep.
Long story short, my grandma was right. Our family lived in Greta.
Right.
Next door to the Kelly family and went to school with all the kids.
Right.
And then, obviously, there's only so much you can learn about Ned Kelly.
That's right, yeah.
I learned that when the Kelly gang left Geraldine, they apparently yelled out, "Long live the days of Dan Morgan and Ben Hall."
Right.
So that struck up my interest about those two bushrangers. If the Kellys admired these two, I needed to learn about them. So I started researching about Ben Hall.
Mm.
Long story short, I appeared in the 2016 short film... The 2016 feature film by Matthew Holmes, The Legend of Ben Hall.
Yeah.
And it's a historically accurate production. We believe as generations move away from reading books, it's important to get visual history. It's very important to have our films historically accurate.
Now look, like myself, you've got no, how shall I put it? No academic qualifications in history, have you?
No, none whatsoever.
So how do you interact with the academics? Do they ignore you completely, or
no? My research is too important to ignore. They can't ignore it.
They can't.
So
it's all up on the Facebook page.
Yes, so I've been recognised by the University of Melbourne, Heritage Victoria, the Victorian Institute.
How have you been recognised?
With my previous research.
Right.
Explaining how Ned's remains ended up from the old Melbourne jail to Pentridge.
Right.
Victorian Institute Forensic Medicine, when the remains were handed to them, and then Tom Baxter, the Western Australian farmer, handed the skull that he stole from the Melbourne jail in 78 that he believed to be Ned Kelly's. Which wasn't Ned Kelly's.
Right.
So my Victorian Institute Forensic Medicine reached out to me regarding...
So you're what's called a gifted amateur. You don't need academic qualifications.
Mate, I'm not an amateur. I'm a professional.
Yeah. No. Well, do you get paid for your work?
No.
No. You're an amateur. Sorry, mate. The definition of a professional is somebody gets paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're amateurs, mate. We're amateur historians. And there's nothing wrong with being an amateur historian.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, you know, what you've done is extraordinary, because what you've done is you've opened up people's eyes to the fact that they can, if they got the time and the passion, and there's a particular, have a particular interest in a, in some, something that's occurred, like Tanaminawai and Morbohina, the Mile Creek Massacre, whatever.
Any subject.
Any subject. The material is there.
Correct.
And it's not about going on the bloody internet. It's about doing that hard research, you know, going to the archives, looking at the material.
Locating forgotten historical sites, making the history come real. These were real people who lived on Earth before us, you know.
Well, we're real people. They had their look. We're not saying they were saints. They were saints and sinners, but they were real people who were reacting to the situation they found themselves in at that particular point in time. As you said, bush rangers, escaped convicts, and then you had all the different manifestations.
Everyone deserves to have their story told.
Right. Even if it's a negative story.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So have you got any plans for the future?
Launching my Ned Kelly tours this year. I had a bit of a trial run last year, and which was quite successful. So
hang on. That's all over bloody Victoria.
Yeah, it will be.
So what is it? A convoy? Is it?
So it'll start off with Melbourne tours on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, where you can visit Dan Kelly, Steve Hart, and Ned Kelly's Armours.
Yep.
And then do a walkthrough of the Melbourne jail.
Yep.
And then on weekends, you'll find me up in Glen Rowan doing walkthroughs of the town.
Right, right.
And telling the history of the famous shootout.
And what do they think of you in Glen Rowan?
I'm considered a local up there.
You're considered a local.
I've got family history to the town.
You got the hat. Well, that's the good thing. And you're going to do this for the rest of your life?
Yeah. As I told you earlier, I'm recovering from a broken collarbone at the moment.
Oh, you told me. You didn't tell the listener.
From surgery. So I've had to reassess my future.
Yeah.
As we mentioned earlier, I've never made money from sharing my research.
That's right.
So I've had to, you know, bite the bullet and start looking at my future as a historian, author, actor, tour guide.
Yeah, I think it's a wise thing to do. Once you've accumulated all that knowledge, you don't want it to go with you to the grave. You need to share it.
Yeah, that's
the wise thing. Now, tell us about this song we're going to do. Oh, you're going to do, not we.
Tell us about this. You can help me sing it if you
want. No. I'll just listen.
Over the last 10 years, I've taught myself how to sing all of the traditional ballads that were written about various bushrangers during the 1800s.
Right.
The idea is this year to start travelling around at night time when I'm not doing my tours, to different pubs, hotels, museums, and sing these traditional ballads and bring the excitement back into the old country pubs. Again, so
well, they need a bit of excitement because most of them are closing down, mate.
Yeah, well, I thought, you know, if I'm going to sing ballads written traditional ballads written in the 1800s, I better write and sing something myself. So.
Right. So you're going to entertain the barflies?
Yeah.
Right.
So
that's fair enough.
So to speak.
So that's fair enough. All right. Tell us about this particular song.
So it's written to the tune I had. The Pub With No Beer was the tune was just playing nonstop over and over in my head earlier in the year or last year. Mm. And so I decided to sit down one day after a couple of whiskies and just start putting some words to the ballad. And it tells the story of the bushrangers bailing up the government.
Tell us, come on.
Yeah, bailing up the government.
It's in the ballad. You don't have to tell us what it's about. It's a ballad. Ballads tell a story. Off you go.
All right.
Get yourself organised. Let me know when you're ready. Yeah, cleared your throat?
Yep.
Let's go for it.
The last bar I robbed, there was no beer at all. So unto the bush telegraph, a message was called. The pub's got no beer, so what do you boys say? Let's get the gang back together and rob the bullock dray. It's carrying beer from near far and wide. Not a drop was spilt along that bumpy roadside. As a bullock, he cracks the stock of his whip. He pulls a flask from his pocket, takes a swig from the hip. To Government House, he sings with much pride, I'll make enough money till the day that I die. When all of a sudden appeared a gang of bush rangers who shouted, stand and deliver, for your life is in danger. The bullock, he pulled the dray to a halt. This thieving banditti began to revolt. After plundering the dray and loading the pack horses, these thieving highwaymen departed for the cause of this daring deed that I just related. When they arrived at the bar where they were celebrated, they paid for all the food and the beer. So raise up your glasses and give those outlaws a cheers.
I think that should go well with the bar flies in regional pubs, maybe in Melbourne pubs.
I've sang it a couple of times.
Have you?
Live,
well, that's good. Look, what I like about you is you've got a bit of daring and a bit of flash, just like the old bush rangers, you know.
Thanks,
you're not
mate.
Famous, but no. You got that daring and you got that flash and you do the hard work. And that's the key to success. It doesn't mean whatever you do, if you're an activist or a researcher, you've got to do the hard work. And I've got a great deal of respect for what you've done over the years, you know, as an amateur. And there's nothing wrong with being an amateur. As I said, professionals get paid. Amateurs don't get paid. I've been here 49 years. Nobody's given me a cent. So I'm an amateur.
Kudos to you, mate.
Yeah, I'm an amateur. So it's really been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you too, Josh.
Now, tell us that Facebook page again, so if people are
Australian
interested.
Australian Bush Rangers.
That's easy, even
on
I
Facebook.
Can remember.
I also run the Harry Powell Bush Ranger page as well, but I share a lot of my research on the Australian Bush Rangers page.
Right, right. Well, thank you very much, mate, and hopefully people go to your Facebook page, and it has been a pleasure talking to you. And I've learned a lot of things, and that's unusual for me to say.
Thank you.
Because I'm a conceited old bastard.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, all the best.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.